Reconstructionist Radio presents a War Room production. The Postno Report with Nathan F. Conkey.
Okay, so welcome to the 50-something edition of the Postmill Report with your host, Nathan Conkey, Nathan F. Conkey to some. Thank you so much for tuning in, whether you're listening, watching the video or listening to it on the podcast. Please do subscribe on iTunes and give a review. Thanks to those who have reviewed already. And today I'm very pleased to be interviewing a Facebook friend of mine and an actual friend of mine. I've actually met him. Wow. This is John Michael Le Bon. Is that right? I hope that's right.
Michael Bion, B-I-O-N.
Sorry, I keep saying Le Bon. I'm thinking of Simon Le Bon from the 80s band, I think. Yes, this is John Michael Bion, like Beyonce, only very different. So we appreciate him taking the time, and we're just going to share a bit of time with him. And I hope that this inspires you and this widens your horizon somewhat and gives you an idea of what is going on in the big wide world, the opportunities, the possibilities that maybe you haven't thought of before. If you have any questions, please do follow up with either myself or Mr. Bion. So firstly, for those who don't know you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your family, your work, and a bit about your background?
Yeah, thanks, Nathan. We sort of have one of those mixed ancestries. We've got we come from Huguenot blood originally, then sort of to Germany, Switzerland, and finally from Switzerland into India as missionaries.
Wow.
And hence we carry British passports today. But that's where the surname comes from.
Okay.
Wow. That's on my father's side. My mother's side, they also come from a line of Christians. My mother's parents were missionaries in the then Bechuanaland Protectorate, which is today Botswana. Both my parents landed up in Rhodesia, and hence I carry the accent I do. I was born and brought up in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. My wife, Lianka, is from South Africa, from a Christian home and a Christian background. Although I have that Christian background, I was not brought up in a Christian home for the first number of years of my life. And the Lord was gracious to me sort of later on in my teens. We studied theology together in South Africa, sort of often known as a bridal institute.
Yes, bridal college.
Yeah, that's right. So that's how we met. And 3 years later, we were married, for which we've obviously been very joyful and grateful for the last, 21 years? Mm. I've got that right, I hope. Following which, we moved up to Zimbabwe and took over a small family farm. Okay. So we had a mixed farm there with cropping and livestock, primarily exporting flowers to the Netherlands.
Wow, that's a big world you got there. Wow, that's awesome.
Sort of calls to Newcastle almost there, isn't it? It's
Yes, but I hear they also exported. There's a growing market in Kenya as well, and Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, former Rhodesia is a bit further away yet. So, wow, that's quite something.
Following that, while we were in Zimbabwe, we were there for a number of years and developed the farm. Sadly, we did have to leave. It became a point where we had to leave. We ended up in South Africa, back in South Africa, and we had a business there for a few years, which we eventually sold up and moved across to the UK, which we've been here for 12 years now.
Okay.
I farmed for most of that time in the UK for a Christian farmer here. Got a lovely relationship with them.
Great.
And for the last 3 years, I've been doing something a little bit sort of wide ball from what my calling is, really. And we've done engraving and woodwork with CNC equipment using lasers and CNC routers and things like that, sort of scratching a living from that for the last couple of years. The Lord has blessed us with with 10 children, one who of whom is not yet born. So we don't know if it's boy or girl, but we have
congratulations.
Thank you. We only have two girls, and the rest are boys at the moment. My eldest is 19. He's mm-hmm. just finishing off his sort of schooling, for want of a word. And he started doing a short course on agronomy and looking to maybe go into do a business management degree to help out with farming.
Okay.
And our youngest presently is two. So we have quite a wide range of ages.
And just to reemphasize what was said about backgrounds and so on, and we should really be very thankful if we do have a Christian background. It really does make a difference, you know. I can claim the privilege of having a Scots Presbyterian background through the Northern Irish branch, and obviously Huguenot is another one of the great branches of Christendom, let's say. So it's a real privilege, you know, even though our fathers weren't perfect, it's a real privilege to be whatever 10th generation, who knows what, Christian. So we're very grateful for that.
Absolutely. It really reinforces the covenant that our Lord has made with us and keeps with us, even when we are unfaithful to that covenant. He is so faithful and in keeping it.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
Three generations. Yeah.
Okay, so you've told us a bit about your background, and a very interesting and varied background it is in the providence of God. And the Lord has kept you in various hairy places, Zimbabwe, with its obvious problems, former Rhodesia, South Africa, which exploded a number of years ago. And there's a lot of media lies told about both countries. There are a lot of myths told about both countries. And hopefully next week I'll be sharing a little bit about myths, national myths, and their importance. So you can maybe tune in for that the following week. We've both spent some time in Africa, but you've spent much more time than me. So if Africa was a person or a family, how would you introduce it to a friend? How would you describe it or introduce it to a friend?
It's quite a tough question, but it's sort of this vast continent with it's just got huge, enormous variation across it. Often when people think of Africa, they might just have one little picture in their mind or something. They might have a picture of, say, poverty I don't know what it might be, pretty beaches or whatever. But of course, it's got immense variation in different peoples and different climates and geography, from high mountains to flat, low deserts. Just the range of languages is beyond words, immense, and dialects and different cultures, of course, that go along with that. And then, of course, all the resources are quite amazing, the natural resources and people resources in Africa. So it's not just one place or one type of people. It's a thriving, fascinating, beautiful place with problems and with great opportunity and hope.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I used to work with, had the privilege of working with Wycliffe Bible Translators for a while, and famously Cameroon had around 350 languages, but Nigeria had over 1,000 languages. So you can appreciate the immense variety. That part of Africa seems to be, the armpit of Africa, as it were, seems to be so very fruitful in the linguistic department. So yes, Africa, yeah, it is a land of opportunity. It's, you know, don't rule it out. Don't rule it out, definitely. So about Africa and about Zimbabwe in particular, why are there so many white Zimbabweans around the world, but so few in Zimbabwe itself?
Yeah, Nathan, it really is. That's down to the old communist thing, unfortunately. The Zimbabwean state tried to bring in a new constitution in the year 1999, as I recall, and failed. It was voted down in quite a dramatic vote. It was the only election they've ever lost. even with all the rigging they do, they lost it hands down.
Is that ZANU-PF?
Correct, yes, the ruling party, mm-hmm. Which effectively was and is a one-party state to a large degree. And what resulted from that was the same old thing as the happened to the kulaks in the Soviet Union. So in order to retain power, the kulak class, the sort of middle class, upper class, had to be destroyed and got rid of, so that there was no stability in society, and society could be reordered to bring in heaven on earth and to maintain the leader's grip on power. The truth is, it wasn't just whites who were affected, of course. Farmers of both European and African descent were violently forced out and evicted from their lands. Of course, the press sort of concentrated on the European side of it. But it was both sides, and the biggest sufferers, of course, were the hundreds of thousands of black employees who lost their livings and everything overnight. As with the Soviet Union, at the time when they took out the kulaks, there was a collapse in the economy almost instantly, really. Famine, death, and decapitalization. I mean, just today I've seen a report that says that Zimbabweans are now the poorest per capita in Africa. So, yes, this is just a return to Soviet ways, really.
It's the epitome of, it's the epitome of sin, isn't it? It's just so self-defeating and just so inducive of physical evil as well as moral evil, the evil of suffering and want. And it's also a very telling portrait of the covenant, how the land is cursed and the people are cursed in a very material sense when they violate the commandments in such a high-handed way, with most notably theft, but also murder and all sorts of depredations of the
right.
Covenant.
I think it's Proverbs 8, 38 maybe, where it 36. Speaks of, you know, all who hate me love death. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that really does work its way out. And there's other expression that, you know, the seed of destruction is sown within the sin itself.
So we have a communist uprising or power grab that led to dramatically evil consequences. And what was Zimbabwe like economically and so on before that those events took place?
Really, in 1980-81, when Mugabe came to power, it was a well-balanced economy across different sectors of the economy. So across from agriculture, mining, industry, tourism, it was well spread. Hmm. Unlike somewhere like Zambia to the north, which was heavily reliant on copper alone.
Yes.
Although there were problems through the 80s to a lesser or greater degree of varying natures, the economy did continue to grow, and in the 90s, there was some freedom, and things were looking sort of upward and more hopeful and everything. But it was particularly this referendum on the constitution that brought the total sort of mayhem, shall we say, and death.
I believe it was an agricultural exporting country, exporting to Africa and around the world. And of course, you were involved in the export of flowers to all the way to Holland. So the idea that some people may have that Africa is an existential basket case, that Africa can't be separated from poverty. Well, that's not true
most definitely not.
Definitely not true. With God's justice, it has every chance of being a blessed place. Not, mind you, the parts of Africa I lived in were very different. They were Islam controlled and very much bound to witchcraft and demonism of various kinds. But you have been living in the UK for 12 years, but you recently left your family and went on a very long trip. So where did you go and why did you go there?
Nathan, in some ways, it sort of dates back to when we left Zimbabwe, which was, 2002, the sort of beginning of this, I suppose. We had had family serve in South Sudan a little bit, and we've always been keenly interested in missions in South Sudan. We've had friends serve there as well. And some years ago, quite some years ago, we wondered whether there wasn't an opportunity to take commerce into South Sudan as a means of slowly bringing in, through commerce, bringing the gospel and stability to that region. Mm. A bit like David Livingstone, who wanted to bring commerce in a way that the slave trade would no longer be required if they had other means of earning an income. And so hand in hand, hand in glove, would go the gospel and commerce.
That was his motto, I believe. And also it was at one stage the motto for the city of Glasgow. Something along those, maybe trade in the gospel, but very similar. And it's a tragedy talking about the influence of Marxism, communism, socialism, all those evil isms that we have separated. We have become, especially in England, especially in the UK, so very beholden to socialism and regarded as a very Christian thing. But part of our ineffectiveness as missionaries of the gospel, as bearers of the gospel, has been, I think, this truncated view of the gospel, that it is in opposition to things like trading, making money, exchanging goods, and so on. So maybe that will jar some people to have that juxtaposition, but it's very much an old Christian association. You think of the Huguenots. What are the Huguenots known for? Well, one of the things it would be their involvement with worldwide shipping, and also their excellent architecture. These weren't poor people. And Scotsmen, what are they known for? Well, they invented almost everything, for one, and they're obviously thrifty and economically successful and so on. So this is definitely an area we need to work in, but you're not going to the most ideal. You can be a pioneer missionary and still be involved in trade and commerce. So maybe that's a new association for some people. I hope it is. I hope that jars people. So pardon me. So getting back to the question, where did you go and why did you go there?
So we obviously with this idea with Sudan, it sort of fell apart for a number of reasons, but mostly because the country just fell into open bloodshed. And so the idea was sort of tucked away. And then a couple of years ago, a few friends, one in particular in Malawi and South Africa and that, why don't you think back to Africa, and particularly why don't you look at Zambia? When I said to them, well, where? You know, they said Zambia. Hmm. Well, I haven't been to Zambia since I was 14 or so years old. Hmm. So I scratched my head and started looking at it and started doing a bit of research. And it very quickly dawned on me that aside from the fact that it is a largely very stable country, yes, it has its few little tiny wobbles and things, something similar to London, I guess. It's a very stable political environment. It's a largely stable-ish economy. It's some big ups and downs on the back of copper and that, but largely stable. But it struck me that here's a country very much in the center of Africa, it has eight different countries bordering it, none of whom produce enough food for themselves. Hmm. And to the south of that is South Africa, which this last year, given it was a drought year in South Africa, but did not produce enough food for itself either.
Really?
Vast giant, yes.
I am very surprised at that.
Yeah, it's an incredible thing. Yeah, it should be taken note of that, yeah. So you've got these sort of two previous breadbaskets, Zimbabwe and South Africa, unable to provide for themselves. And unfortunately, that's going to continue and get worse for some time to come. So I looked at this and I thought, yeah, you've got Mozambique, you've got Malawi, you've got the Congo, vast Congo. You've got all of these. They can't feed themselves. So in a similar way to what we were thinking of originally, Sudan way, we could grow food for surrounding nations, possibly tying up some sort of a contract with agencies that are purchasing food for those nations. So that would be the economic sort of clincher, the market for it, to drive it. But on the back of which, we could use this as the contact point for missions locally to rural Zambians. And that, of course, can take several different shapes, different areas of service. Primarily, obviously, with me coming from a farming background, I would look at farming as being a point where we can use farming methodology as an outreach for folks to folks through a through a concept of family-based discipleship, rather than typical sort of old type missions going out and preaching, but rather befriending, knowing, discipling, particularly with fathers and families.
How did it go? How was it?
I was very pleasantly surprised by Zambia.
Hmm.
To be very candid, one of my concerns, especially after my time in South Africa, even though we had to leave Zimbabwe because of these problems, because of problems there, there wasn't a prejudice in the greater population against a white skin.
Hmm.
There's this mocked up racist problem from the state.
Hmm.
But on the whole, there wasn't one on the ground. Not at all. South Africa, I did feel those pressures. So returning now and going into Zambia, I did return wondering what that would take shape in the form of, how that would look. Would there be this prejudice? And to be honest, from the very get-go, from our landing at the airport, it was I didn't feel it once. It was quite remarkable. I don't think I've ever been to a country that is quite as welcoming to other people.
Well, that is wonderful.
Yeah, no, it was astounding, quite astounding. I got to, in the Lord's providence, rub shoulders with very senior sort of government people, right down to obviously the poorest of the poor. And that sense of welcome and friendliness was across the whole spectrum. It was quite astounding, really. The other thing that struck me is, I mean, when I was younger, Zambia was always seen as a country with a bit of a crime rate.
Yeah.
Not violent crime so much. Just you wouldn't leave your anything, you know, valuable in your car, or even leave your car without somebody to watch over the headlights so that it didn't get stolen.
Right.
And that sort of vanished, to be honest with you. Crime is definitely very low there on the whole. There was an incredible economic vibrancy about the place.
Hmm.
There's just building going on everywhere, particularly in the lower strata of the economic population. Incredible number of tiny shops being built, brick and mortar, not just wood or scraps or anything, but proper little shops and things being built. Just enormous activity.
Well that's quite something for Africa, the Africa that I know at least. Especially Senegal and Dakar, everything looked incredibly poor to me to begin with. But then as I became accustomed to it, I could see that, well, this shack was, you know, a level 4 shack, and this shack was like a level 1 shack, you know. And it really was filthy dirty, and just corrugated tin and cardboard, chicken wire, really very basic. So
obviously, well, there is that, of course. But when you're starting from a level of zero, it's not hard to start getting improvement. And I think those of us who have spent time in Africa can look past that and see the development and how quick some of that development is, really, in the greater scheme of things.
Wonderful.
I think the other thing that particularly struck me, and this is actually very important for Christians who are looking at Africa, it was very, very open to the gospel. You could pick anybody you wanted on the street. You would have been able to have a conversation about Christ and not been rejected. Quite remarkable. Now, and obviously, it's officially it's a Christian country. In practice, it's animism, a mixture of, you know, animism and some biblical ideas.
What I realized, and you do realize this, you're able to see yourself more clearly with the grace of God as you're able to see yourself in the mirror of other cultures that you live in, but we're just as syncretistic as the Africans, except our syncretism takes a very different and a very sophisticated form. We have the syncretism of the great German philosophers and the great French philosophers and the Greek philosophers, but it's every bit as pagan and every bit is ridiculously idolatrous and animistic, except we have an abstract animism, an attributing of life and divine power and so on to ideas, rather, whereas in Africa, the attribution of some sort of divine or demonic power is to objects. So there really is, in principle, very little difference between the two evils. So I wanted to say that in case anybody was tempted to sort of switch off and, you know, look down their snouts at the Africans. And also, you know, as I was talking to Stephen Perks the other day, there's stuff in the news about British values that's being promoted. People are saying that they have British values. But what does that mean? Before the introduction of Christianity, we were painting ourselves blue, you know, and running naked, killing each other and sacrificing children and doing all sorts of evil. So Africa has only had Christianity for 100 years, not much longer than 100 years. So I think we can not afford to be proud as we deal with African folks, you know. In reality, they've come a long way, and we must bear that in mind, I think.
I totally agree. And in fact, I felt that you know, some of the Zambian churches I visited were quite remarkable in their understanding of Scripture and their application of it, some of them. And actually, the businessmen and leaders that I met were very astute, clever. I was most impressed with them, to be honest with you. Yeah, one of the things that the striking things about this desire and interest in Christ and in the Scriptures is, unfortunately, that A, many of them are obviously not saved, but B, there's a very low level of teaching, and as a result, it's a place the sects are just pounding into. So particularly the Jehovah's Witnesses, you're seeing kingdom halls springing up all over the place. And it's a tremendous opportunity, an incredible opportunity that can be seized. There's a wonderful window of opportunity there at the moment.
By the way, I should ask, what is the primary mother tongue, or are there many?
Well, that's very interesting as well, because I think, as we alluded to just now, there are a lot of languages in Africa. I think there's something like 78 different languages and dialects in Zambia, with a population of 14 million. Unofficially, it's probably as much as 18 to 20 million. Because of that range of languages, English, as an old colony, English is the official language. And this was something else that really surprised me. I had a fantastic young Zambian engineer driving me around, and with other folks as well. And wherever they went, they would speak English to other Zambians.
Okay.
And I found it most striking. It wasn't just polite because I was there. That's their general means of communication. There are sort of two main reasons. One is that, obviously, to get across the different cultural and linguistic barriers, they speak English. So somebody from the south of the country would speak English to somebody in the north.
Okay.
Instead of having to learn each other's languages. And culturally, they don't want to speak each other's languages, even if they know them, because
you haven't really known racism until you've spent some time in Africa. there's quite a deep hostility between different tribes and so on. But I mean, I don't know what Zimbabwe's like, to be honest. But you know, that's interesting. Is it like a pidgin? Is it very thick? The English.
No, it's very good English.
Okay.
And the second point was, those who live in the big cities are more urbanized, and so even their mother tongue, let's say it was Bemba, the person who was driving me around was a Bemba, but his Bemba has now changed. It's not as pure, shall we say, as those in the rural areas.
Sure.
He'll have different pronunciations and things. So even those who live in town, although they can speak Bemba with those who are purely from a rural area, they often also speak English. Quite an interesting, interesting little thing. So it makes it very open for foreign English speakers to go there.
Well, that's encouraging news, you know, whether you speak American or British or even Rhodesian. So it's very exciting, and I'm sure lots of people are really interested and want to learn more. But let's focus on the main thing here. What is your vision for a potential work in Africa?
Nathan, the idea really was to try and have an economic entity that would produce an income, A, for anyone who invests in it, obviously, but B, in order to finance missions within that country. Obviously, I'm from an agricultural background, so that's my sort of calling, and so I see that in agriculture and farming. So it was to have a farm that is economically viable, gives return to investors, but then is the touch point and financer for missions within the country. So any investors would obviously have to have that clear understanding and a shared vision. In order to do that, really, our concept is family-based, if I can put it this way, discipleship. Rather than trying to go out and quote-unquote plant a church or preach to people or try and gather people in a place to speak with them, it's more one-on-one personal discipleship. And they can see us, and they get to know you, and they get to know your family, and they can see how you live out the Christian faith in all of life. So that's really the basis of it. Obviously, we can flesh that out and expand it a lot.
That sounds good. So you would take the experience that God has given you with Africa and with agriculture, and obviously whatever Bible training and cross-cultural experience that you had. You even moved to an exotic country called the United Kingdom and survived for 12 years. So you really must be some sort of a cross-cultural ninja. You would take that God-given experience and your theological understanding of the faith for all of life, as we might put it, and really try to apply that in a context where you might be able to leverage those experiences and so on for the sake of the kingdom of God. So it seems fairly clear. What are the economic prospects for such an endeavor? You know, to put it bluntly, is there much money in it, do you think?
I do, Nathan. It does depend on the crops you're looking at. There are issues. For instance, in Zambia, for to be specific, some crops, particularly maize, can be quite political. So especially in an election year, they might, for instance, cap the price that you can sell your maize for, or even ban its export, and they sort of stockpile it within the country. Mm. Obviously, their reasoning is to provide food security for Zambia, but it goes well beyond that. I am encouraged. I've just been informed that they have actually signed a statutory instrument in Parliament there that will do away with that. But of course, that could change at the next government. So it does depend on crops. But yes, I do think it's very viable. There are some businesses that are absolutely thriving. I met with other farmers and Christian farmers who are managing. The Congo is a particular market I have in mind. It's vast. It's all cash up front, and it's a very interesting market.
Really? Okay. Yeah. It's huge, but it has huge logistical problems.
Absolutely.
I mean, are some of the major cities, you'd be bordering Eastern Congo? Or?
No, it's actually sort of Southern Congo.
Southern Congo, right. Okay, yeah. Uh-huh. So that works geographically, yes.
Yeah, it could be east, but no, this particular area we've been looking at doesn't mean we're fixed in this area. It really doesn't. But
there are population centers there, obviously.
Right. You've got Lubumbashi, which is the sort of second largest city in the Congo, not far off the border. And it's also the more peaceful side of Congo, if there is one. The east continues to be a very treacherous.
Yes. I had a couple of friends, a couple of girls. Well, actually one I knew that worked in Eastern Congo with Wycliffe, and they were the first white people there for decades, I think. People were very surprised to see them. I would encourage people to think about, to read The Next Christendom, yes, by Philip Jenkins, and think about the world. And I posted a meme a couple of days ago. It was just a silly throwaway thing, but it was a picture of America with a guy painting blue all around it, and it said, this is how the majority of Americans view the world. And, you know, the same could be said with Europeans to a lesser extent and British people to a lesser extent. But do think about opportunities try to think about it statistically, if nothing else, the major growth in Christendom and in just population terms is happening in the developing world, which is one of the key reasons why I was so keen to come to Puebla, because it is a major city in the developing world. So, but some of the biggest cities will eventually be in Africa. So do think about it. Do read that book or dip into a chapter or two, God's Continent, and think, you know, how can I serve the economically even and for the sake of the gospel, those great urban centres of places that you've never heard of it, like Lubumbashi, or how was it?
Lubumbashi.
Lubumbashi. Yes, my Congolese isn't great, and it's an amazing country as well. They according to one Congolese I spoke to, Congolese, the figure for Christianity is about 99%. So that includes Catholicism and various stuff. But it's an amazingly Christian in some ways part of the world. So I just wanted to emphasize that there's great opportunity in the urban centers of Africa, and there are urban centers that are growing exponentially.
Yeah, absolutely, Nathan. The population, and obviously that's going to affect, you know, geopolitics and economics, is moving to Africa in the present. The population explosion is huge. We've got to be looking at it as Christians.
I think so. And even with all my heart, I think so. With all my heart.
Yeah.
I hope God doesn't call me to Africa again. I don't know. It's in his hands. But, I mean, maybe you are an American living in the Midwest. Maybe you're a European living in Czechoslovakia. You know who you are. Sorry, the Czech Republic. Maybe you're a Brit, but, you know, God could be calling you to some far-flung place.
If I may on that.
Please,
if I
yes, may, please do.
Some of the opportunities. You know, Zambia is a remarkably unregulated country.
And this is the wonderful thing, that there is freedom. I felt a freedom.
Incredibly so.
In Africa, I for some, you know, a trivial thing, but I could carry my knives around with me, you know, without any bureaucrat. You couldn't do that in the UK. Some ridiculous. I remember I whipped out a knife in Northern Ireland at a shop to cut it because the shop assistant couldn't get rid of the security tag, and I think she nearly had a heart attack.
Yeah, I've had the same experience.
anyway, sorry. Go ahead, please.
Because of this, and for other factors as well, you know, the poorness of it. Although Zambia's got an incredible growth rate, it's a growth rate from zero. When Kenneth Kaunda, the socialist sort of dictator, shall we call him, was dethroned, 1991, I think it was. You know, that has 0 point to start from, but the growth rate has been phenomenal. But despite that, there's a lot of quote-unquote poverty. It's not the sort of dirty poverty on the whole that you might see in some other places, but there's a lot of poverty. One of the things that they really do welcome, and you could virtually open anytime you want, anywhere you want, are schools.
Now, don't you be working your magic on me now. none of your voodoo. Yeah, well, that's wonderful.
It is
wonderful, and I think we do have to start considering it, especially if the medium language is English, you know.
One of the conversations I had with a senior sort of pastor in the country, who's quite well known internationally, really, was the question of a Christian curriculum and the development of it.
Oh, obviously, praise God for that.
We would be, particularly, you know, as we talk now, we would obviously be thinking from a more reformed and reconstructionist perspective. So that was the one line of conversation I was having with him. And the other was the translation of materials into native languages.
Yes.
And basically, he said to me, you don't need to translate them. The only thing you might gain in translation is to gain certain nuances or something like that. That somebody may possibly miss in English. So again, it just makes education that much more easy for a Western person going there.
Ironically, Africa can be expensive to live in. I believe
It is.
For a European, and I think this is something that people don't understand quite, but humanly speaking, you're also getting a lot of bang for your buck. Education-wise, you know, your money can go a long way, depending on
Correct.
How you structure the curriculum and so on.
But, Correct.
You're causing me to think now, and it's wonderful news. And hopefully there's somebody that's listening that is thinking that, oh, well, hang on a minute, God is maybe calling me. But I want to just emphasize again that the freedom you have in Africa, for all those Americans who whine about the encroaching bureaucracy, and good on them for doing that, then, you know, if you really want to be free, then do that. There's a Vice documentary. Vice is a channel on YouTube about the cowboy entrepreneurs of Africa, which might stir the blood of some Americans. They're contracted by the UN or somebody like that in South Sudan to supply trucks, and they land in South Africa and buy a few secondhand ones and have to drive them up all the way to, can you imagine, drive them up East Africa to South Sudan. So that might be a good gateway drug for some Americans, you know, to sense the freedom. I think you have to maneuver your way around some petty bureaucracies.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you have to spend a bit of money on the policemen now and then, probably, you know. Broadly speaking, because the state is so weak, is so poorly financed, even if they wanted to, they don't have the personnel, they don't have the power. And there are other powers that rule there. So power is divided. In Islamic countries, the imams rule in charity and in other things. And, you know, churches also have a sort of governmental function in charity and in other areas. So I'm blabbing on. I don't want to steal your thunder at all. But thanks for sharing. And if you do have any questions about the vision, then I do suggest that if John Michael is willing to do this, that you get in touch with him, and perhaps he can clarify that for you. So what materially do you think you need to make your vision happen?
Yeah, thanks, Nathan. Because we haven't got any definite plans yet, I don't have any specifics, but I obviously do have an idea of roughly. I do intend putting together a sort of a business plan and being able to present that to some folks who might be interested.
Good, yes.
For investment purposes. Hmm. I have a small sum that we can put into it, but it's negligible in reality. So I will be looking for people to invest into it as investors. I hate doing plugs like this.
I understand, but you know, in your business plan, let's go through some of the things that you would need to buy. I mean, you would need to rent or buy land.
Correct. So I have looked at a piece of property. Mm-hmm. It's a property that has a huge potential. Initially, we'll probably look at some what I might call low-hanging fruit.
Okay.
So there's an enormous quantity of grass on the property and a huge market for meat.
Wonderful.
We would probably run with that to start with. However, we could also
look... Just getting into specifics there, you're going to need the money to either rent or buy that land, as I say. You're going to need to put up fences. You're going to need to maybe build a house or improve a house. You're going to have transport and contingency money for several months at least. Maybe your return airfare, I don't know. You're going to have to, what else if you were going to into agriculture would you practically need to get? Some transport, of course.
Yeah.
Some farm transport, farm digging, stuff for digging and putting in posts and what have you. Anything
Correct.
Else that an ignoramus like me might have missed?
we obviously just need all the sort of basics. Couple of tractors, transport, four-wheel drive transport is imperative there. Mm-hmm. From the main road to this particular property, it's 20 kilometers. What's that in miles? 15 miles, 16 miles.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of dirt track. So, you're looking at all of that. You're looking at irrigation. There's no electricity, so you're looking at generators or some form of generation, repair of buildings, putting up of all of that sort of infrastructure.
So, so really you're talking about tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Yeah. I think we're looking at sort of $250,000 to $300,000 to start with.
Okay. Yeah, to get yourself started. So, I mean, there are people with money to invest that may be listening to this. And, you know, the thing to do is just, obviously, you're probably liking what you hear. And obviously, the step to take is to get in touch with John Michael. And, you know, he's approachable. He'll talk to you. He won't bite, probably, you know. So, I would encourage you to build up that relationship and to get to know him, to see that he's bona fide. But I think all these things are possible in God's grace. And, you know, it might even appeal to a wider market than just the Faith for All of Life community. I think it's good to get those kind of numbers out in the open. And would you be thinking about developing some crops then afterwards?
Yes, I would, Nathan. Yes, I would. There are sort of a couple of reasons for that. Mm-hmm. I think there's tremendous potential for food cropping. Mm-hmm. There would be potential for feed for certain animals if we would continue into pigs. Mm-hmm. There are other interesting crops that can be looked at. It's a very tropical equatorial climate, really. So you're looking at it at two crops a year for larger crops. Mm. More so if you're looking at, say, cabbages or, you know, row crops and things, you can be looking at more than two crops a year. But there are interesting crops that can be grown as well. For instance, there's this upcoming crop, and I haven't looked into it properly yet, but it's just tickled my interest, is the stevia, which is a replacement for sugar.
Very interesting.
Which I think might be a very interesting market with sugar put aside more and more. So there are a lot of interesting sort of things. We could look at avocados and all sorts of things.
Very good. Well, things are sounding up. Apart from the climate, I don't like a hot climate, to be honest. But
it's not hot, funnily enough.
Oh, okay. What are the temperatures?
Quite pleasant. Maximum in summer, at the peak of the worst month, you might be looking at about 30 Celsius.
Yeah, that's not too bad. It's moist. It'd be rather moist, would it?
Dry then. Okay. But then it becomes moist and temperatures drop to sort of mid-20s to the later 20s.
Mm. And at nighttime, is it cool or is it hot?
A little cooler, 19, 20, 21, 22.
Okay, well, that's bearable.
For the year, it's 19.
Yeah,
With 1,300 millimeters of rainfall.
You're not you're by no means at sea level. You're up quite a bit, aren't you?
Yeah, it's sort of a plateau, a flattish plateau, about 1,250 meters of sea level, roughly speaking, 1,300 meters above sea level.
Okay, so it's reasonably high. We're about 7,500 feet here, so we're in the skies here.
Right, you've got good lungs.
By the way, we talked to, I believe, a friend of yours, Mike Brabo.
Yes.
And he has particular interest in, I don't want to use the word sustainable agriculture. I don't know what the word to use is, but more...
I'm happy with sustainable.
Okay, fine. Sustainable it is. Agriculture, is that an interest of yours or?
It is. I've farmed both what might be termed conventionally and organically on reasonable scales for both of those. I naturally would rather sort of err towards the organic side of things.
Yes.
So I've sort of fallen in between the two. In Africa, it's very difficult to be organic. Don't get the cold winters to control certain pests that you do in say, England or parts of the US. I do have concerns about the use of some pesticides and things like that, but I don't believe that we should not use tools that God has given us. I think that a bulldozer is a fantastic tool. Mm. I just use it to weed my cabbages. So I think carefully and judiciously applying the tools God has given us is what we ought to be doing as Christians.
But it's important that people are aware that you are switched on to the need to be sustainable or whatever the correct word, or to be a better steward. More biblically of the environment in farming. So, you know, this isn't going to be a Monsanto.
No, by no means.
So,
I think the principles are that we must make wise use of the land that God has given us to use so that it is improved, not degraded for future generations. There's a very good group called Foundations Farming, which was started in Zimbabwe. They have some very good stuff, and I've had discussions with them about working together with them in Zambia for the outreach side of things. And they have a couple of principles that they use to bring about sustainable agriculture, which are very good, including minimum disturbance of soil and mulching and getting back nutrients into the soil, building the soils up. But equally, for instance, in Zambia this last year, a pest called an army worm created, the terrible damage to maize crops. It would be foolish to watch that happening and not use some of the tools available to us.
Yes.
So on the one hand, we desperately want to be sustainable, quote unquote, sustainable, and not deplete our soil reserves and our waters and things like that, or poison people with food that's not good. But on the other hand, we would be fools not to save our crop from danger and be economically destroyed, which wouldn't help anybody.
If God blessed you with that capital you needed and all the things that you needed to make things happen, say you're 5 years down the line, you're 10 years down the line, how would you visualize ideally the impact that you could have as a successful farmer in charge of a profitable enterprise? What would be the advantages from a Christian point of view? Paint us a picture of the advantages that you would have.
I've just recently read something of Bergeron Marinov's, and in fact in this he was quoting Joel McDermott as well, to sort of really sink myself there with some people. The emphasis being that it's on commerce that often the kingdom is advanced. It's through the sciences and through commerce and that we have the tools to advance the kingdom. So number one, let's just say it was 10 years. Within those 10 years, you're coming alongside folks, you're gradually, Lord willing, building a community, a covenant community of some sort, of whatever shape that particularly takes. We could hold that for a different discussion. So that is happening in the meantime. But long term, you're building up reserves where you can actually influence culture a lot more, and you can have other businesses and other ventures that I can't even imagine at this stage, and other people will come along with, and you're able to feed into or to fund or whatever it is, which can alter a nation. So, for instance, I mentioned education earlier on. That has definitely been something that's played on our minds. The funding of a thoroughgoing Zambian Christian education system can be put into place. Homeschooling is great, and I'm a firm believer in homeschooling. Obviously, we homeschool our children, but when you're at point zero, parents who don't know how to educate, don't know how to read or write themselves, can't teach their children very well. So they need a lot.
And I want to reiterate that it's very easy. It's very difficult to put ourselves into people's shoes, and this is what we find. Well, this is what I find in Puebla here in Mexico. People don't have the Christian backgrounds, and
right.
But we've had people that within a year or two they began to homeschool. After spending some time, connected with this sort of faithful of life perspective, you don't know what's going to happen, but you have much more leverage starting out with a school. And this isn't Zambia isn't America. Zambia isn't the UK. So you are starting often from a rather low base. I just wanted to interject there. Homeschooling, might happen in several years' time, might happen in a generation,
And that might be the aim. That would be the aim, really, is that parents take more and more responsibility. And that's got to be taught from the very get-go, that is our given responsibility.
And that is possible to do in a school. That's what we do. And, there's a lot of homeschool about the Pierre Viret Learning Center, in that the children look the are able to look adults in the eye, very different from when they first come. They're able to talk to the teachers, as they would do to a parent or an uncle. So, if you start right, you can definitely have a much better product.
Correct. So my thought is that, for instance, in that, say, 10 years that we're looking at, if we're able to finance little schools to get going, which is self-sustaining, obviously, but you're managing to actually have impact in these ways, which is much bigger than the farm itself.
Yes.
But economic hub that can finance things like these. Now, I don't know. Somebody else may come along and have some vision that, I haven't even imagined at the moment. Being on the ground after 2 years, you might say, there's such an opportunity here. Somebody needs to fill this. Because you're there and because you have got an income that's gradually growing from the from the business, you're able to feed into that.
Yeah. I didn't know the answer that you were going to give there, but obviously there are things like you're giving employment to perhaps dozens of local folks.
Oh, absolutely.
And you're giving stability into their lives, and you're affecting whoever serves them, you know, their own food suppliers and so on, and maybe they invest in housing and so on. So you're definitely having an impact. But, you know, having money, it does help, as you said, is like a catalyst, you know, and spending time as well. This is what I find. Yeah, it is really important. I mean, spending time, I only realized what the problem was. Some of the problems were after 2 years, you know, the need for a thoroughgoing, an ESL, Christian ESL curriculum from Spanish to English. I believe that's what I'm going to be working on for the next 2 years to try and do that. But I just didn't know that was what was most needed as a sort of a catalyst for folks. And we've worked on little things like buying secondhand computers, which we're able to then leverage others' time. You just need a small capital investment. MP3 recorders, instead of having the local folks give a dictation in English or even Spanish. I mean, these things can really form the backbone of a school. And also, we have problems with paper-based curriculum, which would be 1,000 times worse in Africa. You know, imagine getting depending upon monthly deliveries of hundreds of, you know, dozens of kilos, hundreds of kilos worth of books. You know, it's just totally impractical. So again, there is a need for some sort of an online curriculum, which maybe you could print out or whatever, but I think it's becoming more and more feasible in Africa to have some sort of a solar array with, netbooks or whatever it happens to be. So definitely with time, if God blesses you with the opportunity, you get to see more. Anyway, for some reason, I'm getting very fired up here, which I don't usually do. I don't usually butt in so much. So thank you for your patience. So moving on a little bit here, what do you think you will need in terms of personnel, men and women with skills, other families, in order to really make this happen?
Nathan, I do see a place for certainly and on the farming side, possibly another family with farming background to come in as well. Talking about this piece of land that I have specifically looked at, the potential is huge, well beyond one man or one family, immediate family's capabilities. Mm. Obviously, I've got children who are coming on, getting older, but sort of more immediately, especially, I think there's tremendous scope for another family to come in as well. Mm. And that sort of doubles the impact of folks watching families as well, and seeing the Christian life lived out when you've got two families both working out faith in every aspect of their lives as well. Who that family might be, I have no idea at the moment. Mm. But I do see scope for that.
Yeah.
Long term, I do see some other ideas as well, not to do with farming.
Yeah.
I see some tremendous service opportunities in Zambia, huge in fact, perhaps I could mention later on. And again, you know, the folks could step into those. They're well beyond my capabilities.
Yeah.
Yes, I definitely see a place for skilled men to come in with a similar vision.
Yeah, Africa is not necessarily a place for inexperienced, you know, the wet behind the ears. Although, I mean, it would be a great place to apprentice, you know, if you had Have you had the stomach for it? That sounds wonderful. And you know, we trust that the Lord will, if he wants to move this to move ahead, we'll be calling people. So be thinking about that, be using your imagination, get in contact with John Michael, certainly.
May I just, in
please,
context,
please do, please do,
context please do. Property, just to set the sort of scale.
Mm.
If it were possible to go ahead with something like this property,
mm.
there could potentially be sort of 400 plus hectares of land for arable agriculture. Wow. That it's large. So and that's just the arable side, not the livestock side. So the potential is there for another family, definitely. But it would take somebody who does have an understanding of some cropping and an ability just to manage it and keep things going, you know.
What do you think a person or a family needs to work effectively for the gospel of the kingdom in Africa? You've already mentioned that they need to have skills, and specifically you're thinking initially of agricultural skills, particularly arable farming. Is there anything else that you would add to the list?
I do think, I mean, obviously, especially if you're going to be working closely with somebody, you do want somebody who's got similar sort of ideas and some vision as to how things should progress. I would say an understanding of the covenant. And of covenant history and how the Lord has worked and works his covenants out with people, an understanding of the sovereignty of God. Because, as I think you've already alluded to, you mentioned just now the logistics of trying to get paper to a school. An understanding of the sovereignty of God is wonderful, because things go wrong. And you can get major delays and major problems, you know, a generator goes down and the part's going to take 2 months to get to you. Things go wrong. You've got to understand the sovereignty of God and everything. So those would be key, and an ability to apply the faith to all of life, not be dualistic, which is obviously a serious problem here in the UK. A willingness to work patiently and disciple patiently folks who have a very different worldview to ourselves. In fact, a totally different concept of what we might call common sense. So where we might say, but wasn't it just common sense to do that? But the truth, that person wasn't.
Rosh Dooney gives an example in one of his easy chair talks about sowing crops by a river that floods every year. It floods to the extent that it washes everything away. And for an animist, it is not by any means common sense to stop doing that. Why? Well, the answer is because it's the spirit that caused the local spirit or demon or whatever the word would be that caused the river to flood. And if you manage to appease that spirit, then of course it'll be okay. So there's no idea, there's no Christian idea, which is what our common sense largely consists in, predictability and time and history. And by the way, that's just to get a dig in against the evangelical and reformed schizophrenics. You know, you are reverting to a pagan worldview when you fail to acknowledge the supremacy of the covenant. And even like Meredith Klein say that the covenant acts in a sort of random fashion in history. You're reducing us in some measure to animists who can't know what will happen in the future, have no real connection between the will of God and what happens on earth, you know. So that I think was is a useful example. You see somebody throwing their money away, throwing their resources away, putting everything in peril, but it's because their lives are dominated by, their worldview is dominated by what the local spirit does.
Correct. If somebody was to go there, they must be able to patiently disciple, slowly but surely, precept upon precept, and not to get disheartened when you suddenly think, well, what happened to this person? I thought he was coming along nicely. Suddenly, how did this happen? Again, as you mentioned earlier on, we've had the gospel for, you know, thousands of years, and the Lord has been very patient with us and merciful. And to realize that some of these folks are brand new to the gospel.
Yeah.
It does take time. So, an understanding of the covenant of God's sovereignty, of being patient. I think part of this really is if whoever it is willing to disciple within the context of their own family, patiently discipling their own children, they would be able to disciple others. If they're not able to disciple their own family, then they're definitely the wrong person. No question about it. I've recently read a book about a Scots Presbyterian who went to Zimbabwe sort of 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. He went out there as a single man, started a boarding school for girls because that was thought was the best way to do missions. Then ended up getting married, having his own children, sending his children off to schools elsewhere. Mm. And this is supposed to be a tremendous example of missions. And it's frankly, it's a complete flop. It's a disaster. But it's supposed to be a complete success because the school is still running in a humanistic way today.
And the sad thing is that Mugabe came out of such a school.
Correct. Mm. Now, my point being that this is why this discipleship within the family and a family orientated thing is actually quite important. So somebody who has these understandings is willing and able to teach them to his own children, live them out before people, will be able to disciple other people in the area. There's that verse in Romans where we must bring every thought captive to Christ and to his word, and proves the perfect will of God. I think there's a lot there for us if we're going to work with other people, bringing all our thoughts constantly captive, and therefore we're able to humbly bring the same to other people. I do think that families are better than individuals. That's not ruling out individuals. Individuals can play a tremendous role. I wouldn't want to be a family going into the east of the Congo. Individuals on an internship program or something like that can be a fantastic aid, tremendous. Mm. But I think from a settled outreach perspective, trying to teach and train people in Christian culture, new disciples in Christian culture, I think it's better done with families.
Yeah, well, I have a short-term commitment to Mexico, short-term being 5 years. And I have been able to be some sort of a catalyst in the learning center and to help out with the media and so on. But... you know, it is quite a lonely station, you know, being in a foreign country as a singleton, you know, and it's something that's best done on a short-term basis, perhaps, you know. And there is a tremendously bad example that is given across Africa by often heroic and godly and self-sacrificing women, much more than the men, who have done remarkable things, but... you know, it just isn't the ideal at all. And no. And I am by no means would I ever dream of detracting from these wonderful ladies and who have sacrificed so much. I wouldn't for a minute want to make any cheap shots against those individuals. But, you know, no. It's our failing as men as much as anything. And I say this to myself. For letting this situation happen and continue. But yeah, so maybe you're a family listening to this. Maybe you're listening to it when it first came out, or you discovered it 6 months or 6 years later. But perhaps God is calling you as a family to up stakes and move. And, you know, if that's the case, God will make it clear to you, and he will in his mercy provide what you need to do that. So moving on. Do you have a time scale in mind before arriving in Africa, or a length of time in mind for giving the work a chance?
I have perhaps three difficulties with that at present. Hmm. One is that my present income, which is my little small business that I scratch at every day, mm-hmm. which has to keep going in the meantime while I plan for a different life. Sure. So that does hinder planning and thinking through to some degree in the present. The second possible hindrance is that I have a little child expected in October.
Sure.
Now, the reason that sort of comes into play is the best time probably to get to somewhere like Zambia to make a fresh start on what is essentially close to completely virgin land mm-hmm. is probably August, September. If in some incredible providence we were able to get go ahead and get finances together and everything this year, I might physically be held back, obviously expecting a baby in October. Mm-hmm. It's just all very tight timing suddenly. I mean, we wouldn't mind having a baby in Zambia. That's not the issue. But it all happening at once at that point is more makes it sort of...
It wouldn't be ideal, would it?
I would like to say that sometime next year, possibly in the drier months, making a start.
Okay.
The reason the drier months is because it's easier to clear the land then.
I'm interested, I'm sure a lot of other people are interested in what is a really exciting reconstructionist project, really applying so many of the principles that we've heard about taking dominion over the land, which is just so important in God's the scheme of things, about sustainable agriculture or whatever the Christian term for that should be, faithful stewardship of the land, about reaching areas which have little gospel exposure. How practically do you think the reconstructionist community can help, could help?
Yeah, I think when you're out, you've already stressed the loneliness of being where you are. Mm-hmm. I think the knowing that you've got support from elsewhere is a big thing. Mm-hmm. Encouragement, especially in times when things are just difficult or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great help, is knowing that there are folks out there, who are praying for you, who could potentially, in a worst case scenario, help you out if something went absolutely wrong. We've been through that, so I would never rule that out. It can happen anywhere in the world, but it can certainly happen in Africa. Mm. I do think that they should be looking at places like Zambia, looking at other countries in Africa, and seeing what can be done, because the windows are huge there. They really are. They're just wide open. Opportunities are there. Where we are finding it very... Obviously, I'm not saying we should not be working to reform our own countries that we're living in. That's not my point, but there are such opportunities with such rewards for little input in Africa. Now, it may not be exactly this project or whatever, but they ought to be looking at different things. Africa's been riddled with AIDS. Tremendous problem of widows and orphans. The training up, the loving, taking in and loving those orphans can have huge impact in the nations. I'm just trying to throw out little examples as they come to mind.
Well, I really do think that it is a moral imperative almost. I mean, we're on this earth to make the best use of God's time, the time that God has given us, should I say. And we are to be stewards of our very lives, and I think we really have to live in terms of where we can get the most bang for our buck.
Right.
We do have it incredibly easy, and Mexico is not a hard station, really. I mean, there's great food here, and there's never a power cut, very, very rarely. I haven't experienced it, and so on. And, it's relatively stable. It is the kidnap capital of the world, but praise the Lord, Puebla seems to be very... quite stable anyway. So we almost have a moral imperative, not necessarily to go to Africa, but to consider going to Africa and to invest, if God has blessed us financially, invest financially in Africa in godly works. And also to, and I think this is this needs to be said, invest your children there. Consider giving your best children, dedicating your best children. I mean, you can't really do that for them, I know, but like Hannah and Samuel, dedicating them to Africa, to other parts of the developing world. Africa needs the best, it needs people who are salty Christians, who have had that that solid homeschool, Christian homeschool, reformed reconstructionist background, and who have started early and are ahead of their peers in the public school. We need people who are well socialized in their families and so on. Well, we need the best. We need to shine the best.
And Nathan, on that topic, that's one of the things. Is a lot of people say, well, it's time that Western Christians stopped going to Africa. They've got the gospel. I hear that quite often, funny enough.
Really? That's,
I don't believe that.
Retarded, a little bit.
Yeah, you just mentioned those young Christians going out who have had a solid home life, mm-hmm. who understand Christ in all areas of life and the application of his law in all areas of life. Those guys go out. The leap it can give to new Christians in Africa is immense. Yeah. They don't have to reinvent the wheel over and over and over again for the next 1,000 years. Mm. They get a start now as young disciples. I think that's a tremendous advantage, and it's precisely the thing we should be trying to do there.
And after 3 years being here, early next month, God willing, we'll have an intern here, which will be exciting. And it's just the very thing. He's a 17-year-old homeschooled guy. He has some skills in woodworking already, and you know that's ideal. You know, he's not going to commit to being here for 3 years. You know, it's going to be a several month commitment. But I think we need to do that. The Jehovah's, the accursed and misled Jehovah's Witnesses, they have their mandatory. And we don't want things to be mandatory because we know we're not Pharisees. We don't want to lord it over people. But they have, let's just say, the culture of foreign missions, be they ever so diabolical. They send their children out to foreign, very foreign cultures on a regular basis, and they just, it's humdrum for them. And because of that, they have won so many souls for hell, you know, into deeper pits of hell. Let's just say, I saw them, you know. I see them here in Mexico. I saw them in Korea. It's quite funny, you know, 6'5" Midwestern farm boys giving out tracts to, you know, 5-foot-tall Koreans, you know, quite incongruous. But, and you're saying this, you've seen them in Africa. Part of the reason why they've gained the disciples is because they put the personnel on the ground.
Correct, yeah.
And it's not just, it's terrible, you know, Africa. You know, I could go to Africa or, you know, yeah, well, you know, I'm not going to make as much money and it's going to cost me in social status and maybe I'm not going to be able to get a house or whatever. Now, fair enough, it's short term. A lot of it is short term. But, you know, if you have a stable base and then a stream of short term folks coming in, I mean, that can be immensely useful as well. But here I'm on my soapbox here, but I think it is something that we, especially the Faith for All of Life crowd, need to address, really think about. Also, I suppose they could give, do consider giving, and this would be giving for investment as well as, you know, missionary type giving. So you know, if you have, you know, $1,000 to give to invest, or $10,000 to invest. Well, do consider that as well. So, are there any other points you'd like to raise that we've maybe not touched upon?
Maybe a negative and a positive combined. I've mentioned that the Zambians are incredibly welcoming people, and they're very open to foreign investment. Very, exceedingly so. For Africa, they're quite a rarity. They allow remittance of income and revenue and all sorts of things, which is quite unusual for Africa. One of the things is with the implosion in South Africa, you've got good Christian families who are moving up to Zambia. Mm-hmm. Farmers, some lovely folks have moved up there, and they'll be a tremendous aid to that nation. Mm. Unfortunately, you will have some people with not so good worldviews and attitudes moving up as well. The more South Africa implodes, the faster that's happening. I already know of massive interest from South African farmers into Zambia and other business people into Zambia. Mm-hmm. My concern is that that window that is of opportunity that is available will tighten and close and become negative to foreign investment. Mm. After a while, because of some bad eggs coming from South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so I would say if somebody was looking at somewhere like Zambia, don't delay for too long. The opportunity is there to get in quite easily at the moment. Yeah. But longer term, that easy entry and welcome may dry up. Mm. because of rotten eggs coming in and spoiling the soup. I'm sad to have to say that, but that's on a sort of different side of things. One of the things I did notice as a tremendous area of opportunity service in Zambia was the supply of energy. They are extremely short of electricity, of power generation. I also happened to come across a chap who has designed portable nuclear power plants. I'm just throwing it out there for anybody who's more capable in those realms than I am.
Some of the Maranov children, maybe. They're probably into, they do nuclear science in their spare time. So you're saying that there's potential for people working in the energy sector to invest, or?
I obviously have not researched that sector at all. Mm-hmm. I don't know just how badly regulated it is, either by regulation or politics, because unfortunately, like anywhere in the world, politics does come into these things. But I am saying I think there's a tremendous opportunity there, definitely.
Okay.
Which looked at by somebody. Yeah. There are other lots of opportunities in Africa, huge opportunities. They've just got to be looked for in whatever your area of skill or calling is.
Yeah.
Tremendous opportunity.
Well, thank you very much. There's a lot there to consider. There's so much to consider. And there's almost a billion people living in Africa. And there's so much opportunity and so much opportunity to make a catalytic change. So there's a lot to pray about there. And, you know, I believe that if you did invest in prayer, invest financially, and invest perhaps some of your time in this project that John Michael is proposing, then, you know, I think it would be time and money and effort well spent. So do give it your prayerful consideration. Do get in touch if you are interested with either myself or John Michael. And if you are interested in knowing more about my work, do get in touch with me through Facebook, facebook.com/christian.education. And we'll leave an email or some kind of contact for John Michael as well. If you're interested in my work here as well, please do consider giving. You can make a tax deductible donation at c10.org/NathanConkey. That's NathanConkey. So thanks again for listening. God bless you. I hope you have a good week and tune in next week.
The Reconstructionist Radio Podcast Network brings to you a complete lineup of podcasts where you will hear practical and tactical theology. Our desire is not simply that you consume our shows, but that you also live out your faith in every area of life. We can talk all day long about these things, but if we fail to put them into practice, then we fail as ambassadors of Jesus Christ, our King. Subscribe now to your favorite Reconstructionist Radio Podcast Network shows, or you can subscribe to the Reconstructionist Radio Master Feed, where all of the content we produce, including the audiobooks and audio articles, will pop up as soon as they are available. And don't forget to visit ReconstructionistRadio.com to volunteer as a narrator or to partner with this ministry financially. May the Holy Spirit stir you into action for Christ and His kingdom.